Okay. My colleague will come back at 6 o'clock and visit.
Okay, so we can read this text then at the end of his career as testifying to the ambition of psychoanalysis. I mean, you can see very much that Freud is intending psychoanalysis to be a general method. After he'd written a critique of religion in 1927 called The Future of an Illusion, and here comes a critique of civilization, an even larger notion, referring in a general sense to material life, I suppose. And of course, the subject of civilization was much in the air at the time. If you think in the German context of Oswald Spengler, the reactionary right-wing writer just prior to Hitler, who wrote a book called The Decline of the West, which was on the end of Western civilization, sounding a note that, of course, many reactionary or conservative commentators have continued to sound throughout the 20th and into the 21st century. Think also of the whole conservative modernist critique of industrial civilization. If you read Pound or T.S. Eliot particularly, that notion of industrial civilization comes up as the object of their critique all the time. It is urbanization, industrial civilization. They don't tend to use the word capitalism very much, but it's capitalism that they're naming and that they're very critical of, in Eliot's case, in the name of a kind of an imagined organic society that had putatively existed in the 17th century. And that was the last time, after that, in Eliot's analysis, a dissociation of sensibility takes place, which we in the 20th century, he says, are somehow trying to reconnect with. So that notion of that conservative critique, post-romantic, anti-democratic usually, elitist for the most part. Always it seems as though certain and privileged figures have culture in them, and that there's a big question of what to do with the rest. Are they to be understood as ignorant masses, the great unwashed, to be discarded in some sense? Or is there a question of should there be some kind of democratic education set up? These are the great questions which run through a European education philosophy from the time of Matthew Arnold, for instance, in the 1860s onwards. If you think of Arnold's work on he speaks of culture in Culture and Anarchy in analogy with religion. He then establishes the poet or the creator, or the writer, as a priest of a certain kind. Freud's dispositions here and throughout his career are decidedly different from those. And I suppose the first point I want us to emphasize, given that Freud says some astoundingly silly things, which it's hard to look beyond. And given those, the first point that I want us to register is the radicalness of the approach to culture. If we can get our heads around why this seems why it might seem so important to us. Let's start then with one of the many counterintuitive formulations that we can find in the text. He begins with the category of the ego or the self, which is a very obvious starting point for somebody surveying the history of Western philosophy in some way to begin with. This is a narrative that takes us back to Descartes, to the notion of the cogito, the I think, therefore I am, that self, inaugurated in European philosophy back in the 17th century. We last term we associated that self with modernity. And he begins with it not as that category is usually understood. On the contrary, he insists at the opening of civilization and its discontents on the deceptiveness of the autonomy and unitariness of the ego. For Descartes, I think, therefore I am, this notion of the self as identical with itself, as something about which you could be certain, that is the ground rule of where you can start your thinking. Freud, in a sense, detonates all that by arguing that self, that unitary self, is in fact a fiction. A very, very disturbing and destabilizing argument, obviously. He says that we're not born with a self. To us, I suppose, that, in the wake of postmodernist theories, that doesn't sound so radical, but it certainly was in the context of modernist philosophy in the 1920s. So he says, we're not born with a self in the sense of an identity which is separate from others. On the contrary, our original existence, he says, is as a bundle of animal drives. We're unable to distinguish ourselves from others, or inside from outside. The image here is of a, what to describe it as then, if you can't describe it as a self, a homunculus, let's call it a being, which is unable to distinguish where it ends and the world begins. That opposition between self and world has not been established. So that the sense of, I mean, we seem to see ourselves as so brilliantly discrete, as it were. I know exactly where my fingertips end and the world begins. And you know, that the self and society, or self and family, seems so obvious a distinction. Part of what Freud is emphasizing is that obviousness is learned. In the beginning, in fact, we have no idea where we end, and there is no sense of world outside. There is only, in fact, our desires for gratification, and the mother's breast, for instance, or our fingertips. None of these things are to be understood as things that we know we have and others don't have. He argues the ego detaches itself. Well, let's look at a formulation here quite early. This is right at the beginning, because I know some of your pages are different from mine. So it's about two pages into chapter one. And he says, normally there's nothing of which we're more certain than the feeling of ourself, of our own ego. It's a paragraph beginning, I have nothing to suggest. What page is that on the volumes that you have? Page four, for those of you that have that. The idea of men's receiving an intimation of their, going further down, this ego appears to us as something autonomous and unitary, very much an analysis of Descartes, marked off distinctly from everything else. That such an appearance is deceptive, and that on the contrary the ego is continued inwards without any sharp delimitation into an unconscious mental entity, is what we designate as the id, and for which it serves as a kind of facade. This was a discovery first made by psychoanalytic research, etc. So think if you're reading through the history of literature, for instance, think of how extraordinarily explosive this idea of the instability of the ego was when writers like Joyce begin to develop interior monologue, when the world of the self, the ordered world of the self, shades over without boundaries into the much more disturbing world of desire and the imagination, so that you actually don't know when you begin to get accounts of madness, for instance, if you're reading any one of the great modernist philosophers, writers, from any quarter. This sense suddenly of the eruption into the world of the ego, of the irrational, of the unconscious, of the deeply subversive, but not in a social sense, merely as a kind of desire. That emerges as a profound challenge in early 20th century writing. And the bourgeois establishment is completely freaked out about it. There are all sorts of works. When D.H. Lawrence writes at the same time as Freud is writing here, his work is banned for its statement of the ubiquity, the universality, if you like, the irrepressibility of sexual desire. The sense in which you don't find that level in the 19th century novel, do you? Even in great 19th century works, in George Eliot, for instance, or in Flaubert, this sense of the relationship between the conscious, the ego, and the unconscious. There isn't a notion of the unconscious at that time. So this is a revolutionary moment. Freud, of course, wants to say that psychoanalysis finds it, and of course psychoanalysis does find it. He's establishing ownership in a certain sense. You could argue that it's there to be discovered in the culture of European modernity at the end of the 19th century, but that's when it begins to be discovered, and he's there at the founding of it. He also goes on, though, to say that the adult's ego feeling cannot have been born cannot have been from the same from the beginning. To say I want, is the result of a process. That isn't what you are at the beginning. Not only because you don't have language, but because that notion of an I separate from the world, I want, subject, verb, object, already is a result of development. And Freud is trying to suggest that in fact that in the beginning there is only, as it were, this bundle of animal desires. So that what we then see when we look back and say that the young infant or the infant is already a little boy or a little girl, for instance, we are actually, there's a form of misrecognition there. There's a kind of misrepresentation that's taking place. We're ignoring a social process which develops that self. That's where Freud begins then, by debunking the idea of the self. Central to our instinctual makeup, he argues, is the drive or the desire. It's never quite clear how to describe what word to use here. The German word is Trieb, which could mean mostly an instinct, a drive, etc. But desire sounds too conscious, doesn't it? So that's not the right term for it here, but we don't really have another term. Drive sounds too animalistic, but, although maybe that is the right term then. So a drive, a desire for gratification. This drive, according to Freud, is self-centered in the sense of being selfish, demanding, insatiable, unreflecting. That is to say, it doesn't reflect. It's impassive. As homunculuses, or whatever, what is the plural of homunculus? As infants, I don't want to say as little people, because that's not what we are yet. In this state, as it were, we want what we want, we want it all, and we want it now. That's how we're to understand original being. And the question for Freud is, what happens to that desire, to that drive, that pitiless, insatiable drive for gratification? He offers us two complementary, two narrative developmental schemas. How we're to understand these, whether they're to be understood as it were, scientific explanations or merely as a certain sense of allegories, I'm not quite sure, particularly when it comes to the anthropological one. So the first of them is anthropological, or phylogenetic, the term. This is going to give us a story of mankind's development from savagery to current civilized state. That's a phylogenetic explanation. He's going to also give us an ontogenetic one concerning the development of ourselves as individual organisms and focusing on biological and psychological features from infancy to maturity. What's interesting about his analysis, or you could say what is the limitation of his analysis, is that those two schemas, those two stories, are run together for him. The ontogenetic tells in some way the same story as the phylogenetic. The history of mankind is replicated in the history of any individual. Ontogenetically, that is to say at the level of the individual, we're given a history of individual development. As we mature, we learn that we can't always get what we want, as the Rolling Stones put it. The pleasure principle, that is to say the drive for gratification, is progressively superseded, he argues, by a reality principle. So I want, is thwarted by reality, by scarcity, by non-presence, by withdrawal, etc. And we are obliged to come up with schemas for dealing with this. The reality principle then emerges as a more calculating, instrumental, mediating agency. If you can't always get what you want, which would be, for Freud, in the first instance, total domination of the other, the endless availability of the mother. In the first instance for him. Once one develops, if we're speaking of genital satisfaction, of sexual gratification, it would be the availability of all people that one wants at all times. What is going to be so interesting is that desire doesn't go away. It isn't as though we say, once I thought I could have all women, But now I only like to fantasize that way. The desire still is there, Freud argues, and is very powerful. In fact, it becomes a means of thinking through resistance, as we'll see. We're unable to achieve those ends, those goals, and the reality principle is the agency that works that through for us. This is how Marcuse puts it in what we'll read next week. With the establishment of the reality principle, the human being, which under the pleasure principle had been hardly more than a bundle of animal drives, has become an organized ego. It strives for what is useful, or at least what it can get, and what can be obtained without damage to itself and to its vital environment. Under the reality principle, the human being develops the function of reason. It learns to test the reality, to distinguish between good and bad, true and false, useful and harmful. Mankind acquires the faculties of attention, memory, and judgment. He becomes a conscious thinking subject, or ego, geared to a rationality which is imposed upon him from the outside. So this is the story that is told by Freud here. It's a story of reconciliation, of adjustment, of maturity, and of devastating loss. It's a story in which that what we want most has to be renounced, which of course is going to have effects. There's a tragic structure to the story. We can't have what we want at all times because it would result in the death of all of those people around us, their domination by us. Also, it would get thwarted. We can't have it. But to the degree that that's what we most want, this is a tragic story. Reality is not a happy zone to live in. It's a zone of repression, indeed. Now, the problem, to put it starkly, and this is how Marcuse puts it, that civilization begins when the primary objective, which is to say integral satisfaction of needs, that's what we want most, integral satisfaction of needs. I want everything that I want now, here, always. That would be integral satisfaction of needs. The problem begins when we have to effectively renounce those. And this is to be understood as civilization, as the achievement of maturation in an individual. You can see where the radical or where the resistant dimension is going to come. Freud can hardly say that this is a bad thing. On the other hand, to the degree to which it involves renunciation, the loss of libido, the loss of the kind of creative energy, it is a bad thing. It's to be understood as fantasy, for instance, becomes the only realm in which we can think, in which we can keep touch with our original instinctive structure. So fantasy becomes tremendously important in this analysis. And if you think of fantasy in the revolutionary imagination, the idea of utopia, for instance, you can begin to see the importance of this analysis. So, sublimation of instinct, this is Freud, sublimation of instinct is an especially conspicuous feature of cultural development. It's what makes it possible for higher psychical activities, scientific, artistic, or ideological, to play such an important part in civilized life. I mean, there's an extraordinary dialectic here, that wanting the integral satisfaction of needs, one sublimates those into acts of genius, for instance. So the great works of culture, great leaps in human imagination or intuition, come about as a result of the sublimation of instinctual, of the desire for integral satisfaction for needs. And are we then happy, as it were, with the works of Shakespeare, or would we rather just have had all people that we wanted at all times? Those seem to be the... Do we have to choose between those? Can we avoid that option? I keep emphasizing the sexual because, of course, that is Freud's emphasis too. He argues that in some sense genital satisfaction is to be understood as the prototype for all notions of happiness. I myself would want to put a great deal of I would want to be cautious about that. It seems to me, for instance, that there are other ways in which we can think about what happiness might be without thinking it in terms of genital satisfaction, but that may just be because I'm terribly repressed. For Freud, of course, that is the place that you look. If one were to yield, he says, to a first impression, one would say that sublimation is a vicissitude which has been forced upon the instincts entirely by civilization. But it would be wiser to reflect upon this a little longer. It's impossible, he says, to overlook the extent to which civilization is built up upon a renunciation of instinct, and how much it presupposed precisely the non-satisfaction by suppression, repression, or some other means of powerful instincts. So civilization and repression go hand in hand. They are the same moment. That's where the radicalness of Freud's analysis occurs. Because for most people, of course, civilization is to be understood in terms of the of paving a way towards an idea of freedom. Freud sees civilization and repression as inextricably interconnected. That's a very unusual conception. You don't find, it is a properly philosophical standpoint. In other words, it stands as a powerful critique, let's say, of various liberal theologies, liberal theories of political development, democracy, etc. I mean, in other words, Freud takes aim both at the American and at the Soviet. The Soviet Union aims to establish an idea of a socialist democracy in which there would be freedom. For Freud, that's meaningless because it fails to grapple with the question of repression, which is at the heart of civilization. Same thing, too, of the American notion, which for him is merely another version of the same thing. At the level of the ontogenetic, that is to say, of the anthropological, Freud explores this problem most significantly through the question of the repression of sexuality. What he gives us is an anthropological story of despoilation and violence. In terms of, he argues that if we're to think through primitive civilizations, that's the word that he uses, we're to imagine a war of all against all, in which certain men, primary males in a certain sense, establish dominance. They conquer, colonize, have their way with their subjects. They would like, as it were, to obtain all women and to establish all women in their harem. All men are to be subordinated to them. That's the model. And civilization then takes shape as the moment at which that idea is contested. The moment at which, for instance, junior males in a household organize themselves against this terrible father who dominates, enslaves, and murders them. Or the moment at which, in some sense, a different notion, an erotic notion of love begins to bind things together. Freud associates this particularly with the historical role of women. We can register this without sort of saying, that his analysis is anthropologically unsound. But what he's talking about is two kinds of, two ethics, if you like, or two impulses. The one towards domination. Aggressivity, as he calls it, which is ineluctable and cannot be reduced. The other towards an amelioration, an attempt to counter the effects of that aggressivity. Culture is formed when a binding takes place, when people rise up to resist the injustice of aggressivity. At the same time, the moment that one emphasizes that, the libidinous impulse of aggressivity, if one chains aggressivity too much, if one doesn't give aggressivity an out, then in fact you're immediately sabotaging civilization. That's the analysis that he gives. He gives us the example of sexuality, and he says, as regards the sexually mature individual, think of this in the early 1920s or even earlier, because it's a point that Freud makes throughout his career. The choice of an object is restricted to the opposite sex. For most people, that would be that would have seemed obvious. For Freud, it seems to be the result of a kind of a mark of domination. The idea that our choice should be restricted to the opposite sex, and most extragenital satisfactions are forbidden as perversions. So you know, instantly you've got the bourgeoisie saying, wait a minute, he seems to be opposed to marriage, etc., etc. And he goes further. The requirement demonstrated in these prohibitions that there shall be a single kind of sexual life for everyone disregards the dissimilarities, whether innate or acquired, in the sexual constitution of human beings. It cuts off a fair number of them from sexual enjoyment, and so becomes the source of serious injustice. The result of such restrictive measures might be that in people who are normal, his language portrays him here, I mean, that isn't the word that we would use today, the majoritarian concept, who are not prevented by their constitution, the whole of their sexual interests would flow without loss into the channels that are left open, which is how we are, as it were, socially trained. If you're a heterosexual, the idea is that your desire should flow without loss into the channels in which they are imagined. You will marry a person of the same class, of the same culture, of the same, and it's as though it's natural. We tend to sort of weed out almost instinctually, don't we, these things. Freud regards all this as the result of severe violence from without. But heterosexual genital love, he says, which has remained exempt from outlawry, is itself restricted by further limitations in the shape of insistence upon legitimacy and monogamy. Nothing could be further removed from the idea of unfettered desire than heterosexual legitimate monogamy for Freud. I mean, one can see so strongly the mark of the social, the mark of civilization upon that institution. And yet we're obliged to find, as it were, our one true love and our deepest desire through that institution. And remarkably, actually, it seems as though we do it. But at what costs is the question that's being asked here. So as Marcuse puts it, the scope of man's desires and the instrumentality for their gratification are immeasurably increased by the reality principle. We can do things with the reality principle. Marriage works some of the time. Our ability to alter reality consciously in accordance with what is useful seems to promise a gradual removal of extraneous barriers to our gratification. However, neither our desires nor our alteration of reality are henceforth our own. They are now organized by our society. And this organization represses and transubstantiates the original instinctual needs. If absence from repression is the archetype of freedom, I mean, that is what freedom is, isn't it? Freedom is absence from repression. That's how we think of freedom. Then, according to Freud, civilization is the struggle against this freedom. Now, that is an astonishing idea. The idea that, in fact, that civilization should be the struggle against freedom. We seem to have come to an extraordinary counterintuitive understanding here. Does it say what it is? Maybe I can just ask you to tell me when it's 5:02. Okay. So that, as I said, Freud argues that there's a similarity between the process of civilization and libidinal development of the individual. So ontogenetic and phylogenetic levels are in a certain sense reflective of one another. So at the phylogenetic level, as we read him, we encounter this violent narrative of rape, pillage, robbery on a grand scale. It's a narrative in which, as in Hobbes's Leviathan, there is, these are Hobbes's words, a war of every man against every man, and in which life is, you remember the famous Hobbesian formulation. I'm not sure all five of these are good for Freud. Solitary, poor, brutish, nasty, brutish in short. Those are Hobbes's. I mean, solitary Yes, in a sense, in that every person is opposed to every other person. I mean, what Freud says about neighbors is just absolutely hairy. What kind of neighbors could he possibly have had that one, you know, one wants to exploit their labor without compensation, you know, to steal their goods, you know, to trample them, to subordinate them to your sexual desires, etc. Well, on the other hand, if you're thinking of the rising tide of anti-Semitism, if you're thinking, for instance, of Nazi rhetoric or of anti-Semitic rhetoric about the Jews, which is in the air at this time. This is not so far-fetched. This idea of a kind of poison, the aggressivity, the need to extirpate or root out. Freud is onto something here, very obviously. As he puts it, men are not gentle creatures who want to be loved and who at the most can defend themselves if they're attacked. They are, on the contrary, creatures among whose instinctual endowments is to be reckoned a powerful share of aggressiveness. As a result, their neighbor is for them not only a potential helper or sexual object, but also someone who tempts them to satisfy their aggressiveness on him, to exploit his capacity to work without compensation, to use him sexually without his consent, to seize his possessions, to humiliate him, to cause him pain, to torture and to kill him. I have these thoughts every day. Homo homini lupus. Man is a wolf to man, is the phrase that he uses there. In consequence of this primary mutual hostility of human beings, Freud says, civilized society is perpetually threatened with disintegration. What he's describing here are two forces, in a sense. Thanatos, as he's going to call them, and Eros, the life instinct, if you like, and the death instinct. But what we need to take away from here is his awareness, his sense that there's nothing one can do about that opposition. It isn't something that is solvable. It isn't something that's resolvable. You can't go in the direction of reality and say, thank goodness I've reached the other shore. Aggression has been left behind. You could do that, as it were, but then you would be in the world of 1984. Winston loved Big Brother, something like that. So what we need to pay attention to is this extraordinary, the volatility, the capacity of what Freud calls aggression, which we can link to the idea of libido or the sexual drive, that peculiar sense in which it is destructive, in that it comes from a desire for universal domination. And yet, at the same time, it also is what constantly pushes us further. It's constantly imagining. It refuses to give up. It can't be tamed or domesticated. It refuses to give up on what it wants. And in that refusal, particularly in an ordered, organized, administered, rationalized society, there is a powerful utopic impulse. So that sense of it is precisely in the realm of fantasy, as Marcuse will say. And the fantasy, of course, is the world in which the rules don't obtain. So at that level, in fantasy, you can get what you want. And we always think, well, okay, that's great. So it only gets dangerous if people try to live out their fantasies. But the suggestion here is that fantasy, in a certain sense, fantasy is what constantly says no to reality, won't allow it. And we shouldn't see, it's very bourgeois, Marcuse will argue, to see fantasy as the necessary corrective or compensation. So every day I'm humiliated and abused at work, but thank God I can go home and masturbate. That would be, you know, the one is as it were merely the compensation for the other. That's not what Freud is suggesting at all. He's suggesting that in fact that fantasy is a powerful political agent in our everyday life. It's not, we can't bracket it off. I mean, if we do that, then we've organized even fantasy. You know, here's fantasy's little playground. That's great. But what he's suggesting is that in fact that in these irrepressible desires, which sometimes we're not courageous enough or even conscious enough or self-conscious enough to acknowledge, to recognize, in those desires, there is a powerful challenge to the organizing, the civilizational, in the bourgeois sense, dynamic, the productive logic, the idea, you know, those subversive thoughts cut against marriage, and they're powerful, is the suggestion, and perhaps suggestive of Marcuse will want to make that very important way of understanding what a different world could be like. For Freud, Freud doesn't have that politically revolutionary or sort of activist dimension to him. He merely sees it as it were an impasse, a struggle, something which can't be resolved. But the great thing about Freud in this capacity, I think, is that sense of when people speak to you of civilization and of reason or whatever it is, and give you this narrative of how we have progressed, Freud is so useful as a way of actually of challenging that argument altogether. So that he suggests at one stage, for instance, but again, we don't trust his anthropology, but we trust his method, if you see what I mean. This is a point that Marcuse is going to make. Don't trust what Freud actually says, trust how he thinks. Because if you trust what he says, he's going to give you the story about boys and girls, about castration envy, penis envy and castration, about civilized man and primitive man, and this is not reliable. It's the way he's thinking, it's the categories that he mobilizes that seem important. Marcuse will develop this further for us. He says, in fact, primitive man was better off in knowing no restrictions of instinct. To counterbalance this, his prospects of enjoying this happiness for any length of time were very slender. Civilized man has exchanged a portion of his possibilities of happiness for a portion of security. And that is both to be understood as an achievement and as a catastrophe. I mean, in one sense, it's so sad that we have had to, is that what we have had to do, to exchange a portion of our possibilities of happiness for a portion of security? We can't do without security, but does it have to, do we have to choose, as it were, between being secure, being safe, or being happy? Why does it have to be that way? Marcuse will try to say no, writing in the 1960s, very much with that sort of atmosphere around him. Freud, writing in a different time, says yes, in a sense. So this is the way it is for him. The point that Freud makes, in common with some of the other work that we've seen, is that happiness is a minority practice, a minoritarian practice. Those who have been able to achieve their desires, to satisfy their needs, have been those who have dominated others. That's the problem. The political problem is, can happiness be democratized? For Freud, no, it can't be. What would it take? Most have been dominated. And specifically, if you're thinking these things through in terms of a sexual division of labor, what the Freudian analysis tends to emphasize is that women have consistently been reduced to the dominated agents in society. So that for women, on Freud's analysis, happiness is almost unimaginable. How would one achieve happiness as a woman? And when one finds happiness as a woman, then the question would be, are you just finding the happiness that has been laid out for you? Which is a terribly depressing but also radical analysis. We'll see that when we come to Luce Irigaray. Is it possible to imagine happiness in a language or in a social logic which is not masculine? So if you find happiness in a masculine logic as a woman, you're accepting domination. If you refuse to find happiness there, where does that leave you? That's the way this analysis goes. Thank you. Oh, we shouldn't stop at that point then. So there's a lot more. It's a tricky argument. I hope I've laid out the skeletons, the skeletal structure, but we can work it through more. In fact, I just want you to understand the sort of basic principles here. And there's a lot for us to talk about, including perhaps some of the silly parts in seminars. Yes, you can turn that off, don't you? That's the